Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, today, August 6, 2003. And let me go through the order of our agenda. We've got a... we're actually going to start at the end of the agenda with a work session on House Bill 3526, just moving the bill to a different committee. Then the second item on the agenda that we'll take up is House Bill 2577. After that, we will look at public hearing on Senate Bill 916. Then we come back to the front of the agenda to take a public hearing on House Bill 3653. Senate Bill 923 is next. Six on the list is Senate Bill 924. Followed by Senate Bill 932, and then we finish up with Senate Bill 914. So we do have a few of these that will be public hearings only. Others we plan to have work sessions as well. So with that, open up a work session on House Bill 3526. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3526 be referred to the House Special Committee on Budget without recommendation as to passage.
Thank you. Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3526 to the House Special Committee on Budget without recommendation as to passage. Any discussion? Any objection? Not? You just order that. It's ordered. That closes the work session on House Bill 3526. And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2577. Senator Nelson.
All right, good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come here. It's my birthday today. I'm 38 years old. The new map, you know, I kept 50 and I said, no, I can't go any further, so I've been going backwards ever since.
You've been a legislator too long.
I'm here to testify. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from Pendleton, and I represent four counties out in eastern Oregon, Morrow, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa. And this House Bill 2577 is a policy statement really on telecommunications, and I just need to give you a little background. This map in front of you is actually the fiber optics in 1999. That's what we had going in 1999, and in 1999 we passed Senate Bill 622, and that sheet that I just gave you now shows you the five connecting rings. I think the last one is just being connected, will be connected in Northwest Oregon this year. That was the start of it. The second page is the growth off of 622. These are just different groups, and they're listed on this side of the page. Umatilla Electric, Douglas Electric, Coons, Curry Electric. These are the people that have tied onto this system, and so now we have another ring, say, down in the Coos County area. We have some things out in my part of the country. We've gone down into east Oregon, and more things on the coast. And then the last phase is also just more people that have created fiber networks. So really what this bill is doing is to create a policy. It gives, I think, this group of folks, this Telecommunications Council, the leverage to... I guess they have the approval of the legislature to go out and try and create and finish up the work that they've done starting with Senate Bill 622 in 1999. So it's been a bill that people have worked together on. There's been a lot of committee meetings on it. I can give you the long story, but the good representative has some amendments to, she wants to add one of her bills into it. They're connected. It has to do with health care, education, connecting the communities. I think we just remember that, connecting communities, access for people. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of people talk about as well, public, private, you know, if you look at this second page, there's so many public-private partnerships that are going on in this situation right now with either co-ops or municipals or whatever, and that's just the real world. And, again, the bottom line is it's giving people access to high-speed large bandwidth telecommunications. We wouldn't have the DSLs out in my part of the country if it wasn't for all the work that these people have done. So. Okay, if there are any questions, there's a whole bunch of people out here, but if you don't want any testimony, they're just willing to let me testify. Pass this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had the privilege of working with Senator Nelson and his staff and the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council and have learned a horrendous amount. And as you know, the healthcare industry is one of the great potential economic boons to our state if we would just have enough healthcare workers to supply. There's a tremendous need for healthcare workers. And the reason I like this bill and then the dash one, I believe, amendment is, we need to teach healthcare. It's the A7s. We need to teach in Baker. We need to teach healthcare in Pendleton, and we need the technology. And 2577 and the dash seven A7 amendments will help this. It's extremely expensive to teach a nurse, and distance learning is required. And what this bill and amendment will do is to focus the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council in coming up with a plan for the state that's with hospitals, with community colleges, with universities, in order to share resources. There is a horrendous need for nursing educators in this field and in the nursing field. The average age is, I think, 54 years old. We aren't going to be able to get that many more nursing educators trained unless we start making it easier, and distance learning will help that. Why can't a university, say OHSU, who has a professor teach someone in Pendleton or in Baker, and distance learning is really required. We need simulation laboratories, mobile simulation laboratories also, that can be shared at the various hospitals and community colleges. So I won't say any more other than that I hope that you pass this bill and the dash A7 amendments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question because I understood that there was already a council and they had been working for a couple of years, and this would be extending them to the next biennium. I want to be sure that I'm on the right track. I see the senator shaking his head, so that's right. So I guess that in reading the bill, I didn't see that there was any end date to this. It was just, to go on forever. And also that there was any oversight or reporting back to the legislature, or, in other words, if there's not another bill, how do we know how much advancement there's going to be, for instance, in teaching in the health services?
In the dash A7s, it sort of takes care of that. Basically, there will be a report back to the legislature in no later than February 1st, 2005.
Oh, I do see it.
Yes.
There it is. Okay. Yes. Thank you, Representative Monsanto.
This thing ends on January 1, 2005, I think, under the original bill.
Right. Okay. I missed it. Okay.
And this is the council that's been together for since the Senate Bill 622. Maybe it wasn't called that in that day, but it's this group of people that has just developed this energy and pushed it forward. And they have so many contacts, and it's just amazing to me. We do medical things from St. Charles that come to Pendleton. We had an orthopedic children's doctor. What do you call it? Orthopedist?
Pediatric orthopedist.
Was making diagnoses from St. Charles and Bend in Pendleton, Oregon, through this system. I mean, so there's just so many good things about it that I really do hope that you pass it on. So we can inundate you with thousands of wonderful stories. I know you have time.
Right. Thank you. Other questions? All right. thank you for your testimony, and don't think we need any more help on this bill, so let's go ahead and close the public hearing on 2577 and open up a work session on House Bill 2577. Representative
Flores. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2577.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of the Dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2577. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2577 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2577 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Backman.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart. Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Excused.
Representative Flores. Aye. Aye.
Chair votes aye, and we'll ask Representative Moss Anderson to carry this bill. And that closes the work session on House Bill 2577. And we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 916 and ask Senator Morse to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Members of the committee, I do appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard in your committee. I want to thank you for that. For the record, my name is Frank Morse, State Senator from District 8, representing Albany and Corvallis. This bill is a response to constituents raising an issue with respect to the ability of family members in corporations that are closely held to have the opportunity to exempt themselves from paying unemployment insurance. Specifically, the Blairs of Albany, constituents of Representative Close and mine, brought this to our attention, and this bill is essentially a technical fix because the statute, the ORS 657.044, it gives a definition of the family members that are eligible to opt out by law from paying unemployment insurance. But interestingly enough, it leaves out the definition of a spouse. The family is defined as parents, daughters, sons, daughters-in-law, sons-in-law, or grandchildren if the corporation elects not to provide coverage for these individuals. That's an existing statute. The oversight is that, and I'm sure it was not intended when this was drafted, but it does not include spouses. And this came by way of an administrative law proceedings that the ruling was the definition of spouses. Spouses do not meet the definition of members of the same family. So it's clearly mm-hmm. is an oversight. It says further on the ruling was any change in the family relationships that qualify for the election under ORS 657.044 must come from the legislature. The administrative law judge wanted to interpret spouses more broadly, but the law was very clear. So what this bill does, very simply, is it changes the definition of family. And the as you look at the definition, it is would be changed to mean members of the same family are persons who are members of a family as parents, step-parents, grandparents, spouses, sons-in-law, daughters-in-law, brothers, sisters, children, stepchildren, adopted children, or grandchildren. So it expands that definition of family. So this bill met considerable favor. There was no opposition as it came through the Senate. It has the endorsement of the Employment Department. In fact, this was one of their issues that they thought about trying to correct in this session as well. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would respectfully ask your support in moving this to the floor of the House and allowing the Blairs and many others to enjoy the benefits of the intended original statute.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been to a family reunion lately, and so I have learned about cousins and how they all put together in family structure. What the proposal change that you've got here makes perfectly good sense to me. I note that one of the issues is some of the people you've added are brothers and sisters, but not brothers and sisters' children. So I'm assuming you're intending to omit cousins or nephews and nieces.
This issue was brought up by the Employment Department about 5 minutes ago.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, and my recommendation is at this late stage of the assembly that if it would meet your pleasure to pass this, and if it needs further adjustment, that we do it in the next session. The statement was that this would represent a very, very small percentage of those that would qualify, actually intending to qualify for this exemption. But you do raise an excellent point, Representative Barnhart. It is not as expansive as it possibly could be.
And just to follow up, it really is a policy question of how far afield you're going to allow before you decide, no, you're going to have to buy the insurance and cover these people. And so it's more than just a drafting issue, it is a policy issue. I would concede and agree with you that spouse certainly ought to be inside that line rather than outside it.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate
your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members.
Don Schellenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, on a second Senator Morris's endorsement of this bill. It came to our attention from a Farm Bureau member who they formed a corporation when their father was alive, and their father has now passed away. They were covered under the exemption because they were sons. But now that their father has passed away, the reinterpretation is that they are no longer sons, apparently because their father has passed away, and it doesn't provide for brothers. So the new wording here does provide for brothers, and so we're appreciative of that, and simply again would ask that the committee move this bill to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else who wished to testify on this bill? Well, seeing none, then we'll close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 916. Rep. Gatzline?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 916 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Backlund has moved Senate Bill 916 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll stand at ease.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that I move to withdraw the motion.
Okay.
I move to
Representative
withdraw the motion.
Backlund withdraws the motion to move the bill and There's no vote required on that. So with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 916. And just as information, colleagues, there was additional amendments that had been proposed on that bill that just have not, that are not ready yet. So we will be considering those over the next few days. But we will... Sorry, I didn't communicate that before I left. And so we... And while we're between bills here, colleagues, I'm going to request unanimous consent for Representative Close to vote on Senate Bill, or I'm sorry, House Bill 2577. Without objection, so ordered. Representative Close, how do you vote?
Vote aye.
Close votes aye.
Thank you.
And we will open up now a public hearing on House Bill 3653. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First, let me clear up a little something that has nothing to do with the bill. There have been questions. This is a Yellow Submarine tie from the Beatles collection. Yellow Submarine was a song on the Revolver album during a period of time when John and Paul would write one song per album for Ringo, which was a challenge because he had a limited vocal range. So, and this was one of the songs that Ringo sang. So I hope that answers Representative Barnhart, your questions about the tie.
Thank you. I've been wondering about that all day. I appreciate it.
Representative Cruz, I have that album. That's how old I am.
Representative Close, that would make you still young. Okay.
Oh, no. Representative Backlund?
Before you begin, Representative, I want to compliment you. You've been here for several minutes. You've been unusually patient. And I'm not sure that's always the case, so I want to congratulate you.
Well, thank you, Representative. I'm not quite sure how to take that.
I think it's a compliment.
Okay, thank you.
Interesting, recognizing when Mr. Representative Cruz is out of character from his normal character. Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the bill. Colleagues, as most of you are aware, I have been involved in work on health care, not only this session, but for several sessions. And this session, we have done a great deal of work and in trying to not only save the Medicaid system, but to take a broader look at health care from the perspective of the state. For the last decade, since the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan, the focus has clearly been on Medicaid. And clearly there are implications in all things we do relative to the entire healthcare system, as has been demonstrated this session and a lot of the discussions we have had. House Bill 3624 was the big Medicaid bill that has already passed the House, and I think within the next week will be on the Senate floor for a vote, and then will be on the governor's desk, a significant piece of legislation. But while we were having this months and months of debate, we took a look at what the future of health care in Oregon looked like and how we could get a handle on it. And so we looked at some of the advisory councils we had in the area of health care and wondered if this was indeed the structure we needed or if it would make sense to do some reconfiguration. The tagline on this bill says abolishes Oregon Health Council. That's what shows up on the internet, and it sounds pretty draconian because it doesn't go on to say that it creates the Oregon Health Policy Commission. So we're removing one thing and replacing it with something else and reconfiguring the makeup of that commission. Which is basically on page one and ends on page two of the bill, and part of the reason for doing this is we need to make sure that the people that are sitting on this advisory body have a broad context of the issues in the state of Oregon, not just issues relative to the inside workings of the healthcare system, because clearly the decisions we make and the directions we go have impacts beyond just the healthcare system itself. So this will allow us to make sure that business is fully represented, advocates are fully represented, all of the broad matrix of the state of Oregon is represented. Plus, we're also putting legislators on this commission as ex-official members, so that we have a clear connection to the Legislative Assembly as to the work of this commission. It does not say so in the bill. It says to House members appointed by the Speaker, to Senate members appointed by the President. We are assuming, and which has been standard practice in things like this, that the Speaker would appoint a Republican and a Democrat, as would the President. That's standard practice. There were some concerns over whether that should be stated specifically in the bill. We did not think it necessary to do that, because that is the standard practice, and history shows that's usually the way these appointments go. There were some concerns over some of the language in the bill, not a lot, which is why you have the Dash 1 amendments. And those concerns were that in giving this body, number one, the primary work of this body is to be looking at the full context of healthcare and have the ability to create work groups to look into shortages and things like that we know are on the table, and give us a coordinated way to take a look at that and bring back to the legislature and the administration potential solutions to deal with those problems. But we also, to shine a brighter light on the way the process works, we wanted this body to have the ability to review things like plan amendments, administrative rules, and different things like that go on inside the agency, so that not only would this body have a better working knowledge of all the process that goes on, but so we would have an external point to the agency to make sure that the direction the agency was going did not conflict with the intent of the legislation they were, for example, writing a rule to address. And we think that's very appropriate. One of the concerns on the front end was violation of federal law in doing that. We don't think this does that, because that review would be on the front end of the actual, let's say, for example, we're talking about a plan amendment. It would be enough on the front end of that plan amendment so that the input could go back to the agency so that their normal process could still proceed. It's not our intention of creating an agency that has the ability to stop what, for example, OMAP would be doing, because OMAP has its functions, and they have to do plan amendments, they have to change protocols, they have to write administrative rules. We appreciate that, and we're not trying to stop that. We just want to have a body that has the ability to say, what about this? Or, wait a minute, is this really what you meant to say, sort of thing, on the front end of it, so that they have the ability to get in line maybe a little more than they would have been otherwise on the front end of a rule writing process. I've worked very closely with Dr. Goldberg, who will be deeply involved in this, and also with the governor's office on the creation of this thing. We have support pretty much across the board on this change in the way we are going to set policy for healthcare in the state of Oregon. That's basically the essence of this thing. I think this will be a multi-step process to get to the type of policy structure for healthcare that we want in the state of Oregon. Clearly, there are a lot of other places where policy is made that have implications on the healthcare system. it was never our intent to roll everything into one body and move forward from that point. So we just wanted to kind of do this minor but at the same time significant shift as a beginning point, see how this works, and then revisit the issue and see how all of the other boards and commissions that we have that do set policy fit into this matrix after this has been on the ground and had a chance to operate for a year or two. So I think this is a very positive move for the state. We've been trying to get some transparency into the decision-making process and also get more coordination between the executive and legislative branches in how things move forward with time. An example of how this would work, and we'll look specifically at the writing of administrative rules. The agency would propose an administrative rule. Dr. Goldberg's shop would email out to this commission the proposed rule, the either the state or federal statute that it's meant to address. They would review that. If there were concerns, they could ask questions back. And I'm here to tell you that most of the time, there won't be any concerns, because most of them are fairly minor. But there is an advantage to this body seeing all of the work that goes on, so they have a better feel for the whole body of the way it works. Now, it's going to require a lot of email reading, obviously, by the members of this commission, but we think it's important that their knowledge of the system be as complete as possible, and this will allow us to make that happen. So that's maybe all I want to say at this point in time, Mr. Chair. I'd answer any questions. We have Jim Edge from OMAP is here with some concerns, and if you would allow, I would like to stay here to put on record some responses to those concerns. Sure. So,
yeah, that'd be fine. Any questions, Representative Cruz? Representative Berger?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cruz, I noticed that you didn't have like one Republican and one Democrat, and I'll just assume, as you've done, that would be done, because I think that would be necessary. The other thing is the compensation and expenses, and I noticed that the members are going to be entitled to that, and I presume that would be including members of the legislature who are non-voting advisory members. I want to be sure that I approve of that. I think sometimes that we do too much of that. How often do you think the commission will meet? These terms are for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. We were envisioning quarterly meetings of this commission with the ability to have other meetings as necessary. And in most cases for commissions like this, the legislatures who are ex officio, their compensation comes out of the legislative budget, not from the commission. And also keep in mind that this is the elimination of one body and the replacement of that with another body. So the compensation that was over here is now over here. So
follow up, Mr. Chair. Section 13 talks about the statement that we all file in economic interest. And it goes through all the list of people. Is there some dramatic change? This was obviously added to this bill. Is unrelated, actually, to your commission, I believe.
Ms. Chair, Representative Berger, all this is current statute, and all that is added because we are eliminating the Oregon Health Council and replacing it with the Oregon Health Policy Commission. So it just, they were already included here. It's just making the name change.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Further questions? Representative Monica Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, are there other commissions or task force that deal with Medicaid, OMAP? Is there going to be a conflict between, I just don't want to see all these different committees, commissions, et cetera, that may have overlapping interests. And I just am not familiar enough with all of the commissions for health care.
Well, Ms. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, there are there are two bodies that are currently under the council that we're eliminating. They still reside under the new commission. Okay. The one that was on the outside was the Medicaid Advisory Committee that is now included. But the other two, it doesn't change that matrix. All we're doing is we're starting at the top, we're renaming the thing and reconfiguring the makeup, but the structure underneath still stays in place.
Yes, Paula?
Yes, Paula?
So this will be the main body. It's called, just a minute, whatever it's called. And then underneath that is the Medicaid Advisory Committee and others. I mean, all of them will be sort of coordinated underneath this one body then? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you for testimony.
Do we have Jim Edge up, so while I'm still sitting here?
Oh, while you're sitting here?
Yes. So, well, that's an agreement we had because the OMAP did have some concerns, and we thought it would be helpful if I put intent on the record relative to those concerns.
Okay. Jim Edge?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Edge. I'm the Assistant Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. I'd just like to say for the record, first of all, that we support the concept of this bill and the purpose of the bill. We think it's a good idea to coordinate health policy across state government. And in that sense, we're totally behind the bill and the purpose of the bill. We had just a couple of minor wording concerns, mostly about the words of the bill. And one of them had to do with the subjects that the commission would deal with, and it speaks to waivers and waiver amendments and state plan amendments and rules, and also makes mention of the word protocols. The word protocol, depending on how it's defined, can dig down pretty deeply into day-to-day operations of the agency, and we were just a little bit concerned that it might be a little bit too deeply into the agency on a day-to-day basis. And we have talked with Representative Cruz about that, and we are comfortable with his feeling about that, but I'll let him just
Could Ms. Chair respond to that particular point? We looked at that, and Jim's right to a degree. Protocols deal with minutia, but occasionally protocols deal with significant policy issues also, and clearly it is not our intent to micromanage in any way, shape, or form, but the fear was that if we eliminated protocols that we might miss some big things that should be included. So, as this thing evolves, I think we will find that Dr. Goldberg will have the discretion to make a determination based on conversations, with the new commission as to what level minutia needs to come before the commission. And I don't anticipate a micromanagement here at all. It's not our intention. It's not our desire. But we just don't want, we want to make sure we don't miss things that are significant.
Thank you, Representative Cruz. The other issue I was just going to mention briefly was it speaks in the wording of this bill that the department shall work with the commission to resolve the concerns of the commission. That's the modified wording from what was in the bill prior to the amendment, which spoke about approval and disapproval. So we're more comfortable with this wording, but still the issue of who decides when a concern has been resolved is a little bit of an issue for us, in that does that mean that an unresolved issue could hold up decision making by the agency indefinitely? And if so, that would violate some federal statutes which require that the the single state Medicaid agency not have its decision-making impaired by any other state entities. And there are statutes on the federal regulations that we might be in violation of, and we don't want to get crossways with those because of the fact that we get a significant amount of the money in the Medicaid agency through the feds. So we just wanted to address that issue.
And if, Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that one, we tried to soften the language and to a level that I personally am comfortable with. We are assuming, and for the record, we are assuming that the determination as to whether the issue is resolved rests with the agency. And with that assumption that OMAP would be the one who would make the determination as to whether the issue was resolved should satisfy the fact that they still are in the driver's seat and should we shouldn't raise any issues with federal government at that point.
Okay, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. So if I could inquire on this topic. So there might be a situation arise in which the resolution was an agreement to disagree with the agency making the decision.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not a health care fanatic like Representative Cruz is, so I would like further clarification in Section 9. What's an example of a Medicaid protocol?
There are a couple of definitions of protocol. One is a very formal definition, and that is we have an operational protocol which we supply to the federal government, which defines the day-to-day operations of the state Medicaid agency. There also are protocols about just how we do things on a day-to-day basis within the agency, too. But this could be referenced to either one, but usually we use the term operational protocol in the agency to refer to that cookbook that we have that's an agreement between us and the federal government about how we operate on a day-to-day basis.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Close, that kind of led us to the conundrum because protocols at that level can get into there may be significant changes in relationships and that sort of stuff. We wanted to make sure that we were aware of ongoing, not necessarily looking at the wording of the sentence in the book sort of thing. So,
okay. All right. Representative
Backlund. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question's for Jim. Jim, you stated unequivocally that you support the purpose of the bill, and then you went on to say you do have some concerns. Does that mean, though, that in the end you will be supporting the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, yes, we will support this bill. We think it's a good idea to coordinate and consolidate health policy across state governments. So getting our concerns clarified is what we wanted to do, and we do support the bill.
Thank you. Anything further? All right, Representative Moore Sanderson.
Thank you. I had the similar concerns in Section 9. I thought my lands, we want Medicaid to be accountable for sure, but for us to get that involved. So I'm happy to see the amendment, which does soften, but I still would like to get on the record that I would hope it's not the intent of the legislators to make this a political venue and to politicize some issues that the Medicaid department is accomplishing or trying to accomplish.
Chair Doyle and Representative Mona Sanderson, clearly that's not our intention, and keep in mind that the four legislators are ex officio members, they are non-voting members, and the 10-member board is the ones who will actually make the policy decisions going forward in time, but just as clearly, I think that the greater our understanding of the workings of the healthcare system are, the better we're going to be prepared to deal with the significant issues that are going to face us in the future.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Bruce Goldberg, Dr. Goldberg.
Mr. Chair. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. I wanted to spend just a moment, because I think this has been a great discussion, speaking in support of the bill and actually also speaking to, I think, what is the big issue here, which is intent. I don't need to go on and bore you with the fact that we're facing huge healthcare issues in our state. This is not just about Medicaid. This is about issues about the rising cost of healthcare. It's about issues of access to care for both insured and uninsured. It's about our healthcare workforce. It's about professional liability issues and how they affect that. It's about training. And it's about quality. And we face challenges in all of these arenas. And what I feel that we need as a state is a deliberative, educated, broad-based body that helps us deal with a lot of these extremely complex issues. And the intent of this bill was, I think, rather than abolish something, I would call it reconnecting and reinvigorating a body which was established to begin that process. However, I think now there's a real need to reconnect a body like that with the legislators as well, so that we can have truly a process whereby we have citizens, we have experts, and we have legislators dealing with what are complex issues in our state and helping the legislature work on and devise what's the best health policy. I really view a commission like this as being a commission to advise, support, and provide information to legislators who are ultimately the folks in our state who make health policy. And we need to create a forum and a body to do that. And we need to create a forum and a body that connects the legislative branch to that process.
Questions? All right. Thank you, Doctor. No one else signed up to testify on this bill, so we can close the public hearing on House Bill 3653 and open up a work session on House Bill 3653.
Well, if you're sure. Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3653.
Representative Flores moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3653. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so ordered. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of House Bill 3653. I would move House Bill 3653 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves House Bill 3653 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and we'll ask Representative Cruz to carry this bill. It closes the work session on House Bill 3653, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 923. And Carl Levy and Jeanette Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, staff attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors, here today to offer our support to Senate Bill 923, which was introduced at our request. This bill closely follows House Bill 2545, which is a bill that the House of Representatives passed unanimously back in March, but unfortunately ended up on the Titanic, known as the Senate Water and Land Use Committee, did go down with the ship over there. So we were forced to reintroduce the bill as a new bill, and that is what is before you today. In the meantime, we did go and have some negotiations with the Division of State Lands. I'm happy to report that they now support the bill. Jeanette Holman is here to offer their testimony, and I want to thank her for all of her help in drafting a bill that accomplishes our objectives and is a bill that they now support. In a nutshell, the issue that you're dealing with here is the state reservation of mineral and geothermal rights when the state sells properties to third parties. We have a situation where one of our members encountered a piece of property that had this reservation on it and needed a release, encountered some difficulties in doing that. I have attached his testimony to my own. I would ask that you incorporate that by reference. He apologizes. He was unable to make it down here today. What this bill does is it says that from here on in, when the Division of State Lands sells real property that is within an urban growth boundary or smaller than 3 acres in zone rural residential, they cannot reserve those rights. They have to sell the full fee interest in the real property, and they have to, of course, get fair market value for it. It also requires the Division of State Lands to create an administrative process for a landowner to utilize if a landowner has a reservation on his land and wishes to have that removed, again, for real property that is inside of an urban growth boundary or smaller than 3 acres. The amendments, the bill that you see before you is different from 2545 in that we ensured there could be no net loss to the state in the odd and unusual circumstance where these mineral rights do have some value. The division would be allowed to ask the landowner to pay for that value, and then if the landowner wishes to, he would. If not, he could withdraw his application for release. With that, I will conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. And ask Jeanette Holman first to testify and see if there's questions of the panel. And Ms. Holman, we do have your written testimony, and I hope you can just summarize this.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman, the Assistant Director for Finance and Administration for the Division of State Lands. I'm very pleased to be here with Harlan today to support Senate Bill 923. I, too, appreciate the opportunity that the two of us had to put our heads together and come up with a bill that serves everyone's purposes. I think Harlan actually has covered 99% of my testimony. The only thing I would add is we have rules right now that will need amended to adjust to these changes, and I'm already corralling Harlan to make sure he's there to be involved in that rule writing process. And with that, I would also answer questions if anyone has them.
All right. Questions? Representative Berger.
I don't think I have a question, Mr. Chairman, but I would like to make a comment, and that is in reading the attached testimony from the individual. It does concern me, and I know that it concerns other legislators when we hear from constituents that are trying to deal with problems through state agencies, that rightly or wrongly they leave with the feeling that they have not been listened to and that their concerns have not been addressed. And they then come this route of trying to get a bill into the legislature to correct that. I would hope that we can all do a better job. So no personal intent to either of you, but just a comment on the testimony you've attached.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an area of first impression for me. I haven't run into this issue of the Division of State Lands and mineral rights before. Why is it that we would reserve mineral rights at all when we sell real property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, mineral rights are made a part of the Common School Fund Trust lands. That's where it starts. All of the mineral rights of the state were reserved, and proceeds from those go to the Common School Fund. And there's actually kind of conflicting statutory language even now that says we can sell these mineral rights, but there's also language that says that the state land board shall reserve all mineral rights on all property that we sell, unless they make a finding that it is in the public benefit to sell those rights. So it was a decision made by the legislature in the 1970s that kind of brought us to this point today. Because traditionally, the land board, when they do sell land, have always reserved the mineral rights.
Other questions?
Okay. No, that, I think that answers it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No one else scheduled to testify on this, so we can close public hearing on Senate Bill 923, open a work session on Senate Bill 923. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 923 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 923 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Just briefly, if I understand the way this thing is put together, all it does really is allow the Division of State Lands to sell with the mineral rights attached, lands that are within urban growth boundaries, or for residential use on parcels of less than 3 acres, and that any rights of mineral or geothermal resources included in the sale price of that real estate. If I understand it, it basically says that owners who purchased before that time can come and ask for the division to give up that, the department to give up those rights. It seems like a very reasonable way of dealing with the issue raised by Harlan Levy and the real estate board.
Okay. And as a reminder, colleagues, this is one of our recycled bills. This was House Bill 2545, which passed the House floor 56-0 with four absences.
That probably explains why I thought I'd think it's reasonable.
Yeah.
Since I probably voted for it before.
Right. All right. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative
Forrest.
Aye.
Representative
Canada.
Aye.
Representative Berger. Aye. Chair votes aye. And... would this be a candidate for the consent calendar?
Since we've heard it before.
Mr. Chair, based on some conversations I've had with colleagues, I've been asked not to consent to consent calendaring bills, and so I'm going to object. Mm-hmm. And I apologize for that, because this is one that I think should go on the consent calendar.
Okay. Representative?
Consent calendar.
Oh, yes.
Are you interested in carrying the bill?
No, but if you want me to, I will.
I think it's appropriate. Representative Barnhart, carry. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 923. Now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 924. All right. Stand at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Greg McPherson, representative from House District 38. You have before you a bill which, aside from the number, is exactly the same bill you had before you before in the form of House Bill 3602, which would add to the long list of exemptions that applies to the workers' compensation statute an additional exemption for workers who are engaged in language translation and interpretation services, whose services are engaged through an agent or broker. This is a bill that passed through a couple months ago through this committee and went past the House without any negative votes, and then went over to the Senate side, and through just some procedural tangle that occurred over there, died over on that side, so it was reintroduced as Senate Bill 924. It has been supported by the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which oversees the workers' compensation system, so I think there's really no controversy about it, and I won't take up more of your time unless you have questions.
Any questions? Doesn't look like it. Representative, appreciate your testimony. Dave Barrows?
Yes.
No? Okay. With that then, that no one else scheduled to testify on this, we can close the public hearing on Senate Bill 924 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 924. Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 924 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 924 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support this bill. I just noticed some interesting phraseology that I thought I would call to our attention. It earlier died an untimely and blameless death. Pretty dramatic. Got my attention. Is that the work of the representative? At any rate, I appreciate that.
Do we need a translation?
No.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to inquire if Representative Barnhart was also going to be enlisted to carry this bill.
No, this will be
a suggestion. Yeah. Right.
Any other discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and this is not a consent calendar item either.
We're sure that we're not consent.
Well, I have, again, Mr. Chair, I have the same problem I did on the other bill. It's not a problem with the bill; it's a problem in other places.
Okay.
It will be if I carry, it'll be a very short floor speech, I can assure you.
With that guarantee, we'll assign Representative McPherson to carry this bill, Senate Bill 924. Pass to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on Senate Bill 924. Thank you.
Thank you. Here.
And we now open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 932 and ask John Schultz. You tag team this with Mr. Shipwreck, Bob Shipwreck as well.
John. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Schultz, and I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services, and I'm here today to ask your support of Senate Bill 932. Existing workers' compensation law bars a claim unless a notice is given to the employer within 1 year after the date of the accident, as long as the employer had knowledge of the injury or death, or if the worker died within 180 days of the accident. And what this bill does is it adds one more exception in order not to bar a claim when it's filed late. And essentially what this bill does, the language is on lines 22 and 23 of the bill, is in adding one more exception, it basically states that the worker or the worker's beneficiaries must establish that the worker had good cause for failure to give notice within 90 days after the accident. And an example of why this might occur or what good cause might be is that a worker may be working out of a union hall or working for a series of employers and suffers an injury and actually does file a claim, but files the claim with the wrong employer. Employer's insurer undertakes an investigation of the claim, subsequently may deny the claim. By the time the worker gets around to actually identifying the correct employer and filing a claim with the correct employers, 90 days have run, and the worker is barred by law
from filing that claim, and there are no exceptions under the existing law. So we would ask your support of this bill and respectfully request that you recommend a do-pass recommendation.
Mr. Shiprack?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades. I put this bill in. It may look familiar. It's passed the House unanimously once before out of Representative Close's committee. Just a refresher, John hit the key points of why this bill is in. There was a change in the law in 95. I don't know if it was intended or not, but as John described, a worker can have the best intentions possible, but if they don't do this right within 90 days, even though the claim is clearly compensable, they are barred from any remedy whatsoever. This bill puts in that, and it is, the burden is on the worker to prove that there was a just cause for why the claim wasn't perfected within 90 days. Other examples, and I just friends of mine have had, one of my friends filed a claim and he thought it was an aggravation. Well, it was a new injury. Well, how did he know? His shoulder hurt. A lot of people, despite what some common perceptions are, a lot of workers will just work hurt thinking they'll get better. Well, they don't, and finally they have to go to the doctor, and 3 months has passed, and can't file the claim, and they're just trying to work with the employer. So I'll just be quiet there. But that's some of the examples. These are very few claims, but when they occur, they are very devastating to the worker because they should have been in the system, and through no fault of their own, they'll then end up barred from going into the system.
Okay. Any questions? All right. Thank you for testimony. And no one else scheduled to testify, so we can close the hearing, public hearing on Senate Bill 932 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 932. There's a force.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 932 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 932 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Objecting to consent calendar on this one as well, Representative? All right. Are you ready to carry this one as well? All right. Representative Barnhart will be the carrier.
I'll also make Representative McPherson's promise.
Appreciate that. Okay. That then closes the work session on Senate Bill 932. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 914. Rob Douglas.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Self-Insurers Association, advocating the passage of Senate Bill 914. The language contained in Senate Bill 914 may look familiar to you. That is because it is word for word the language that was contained in House Bill 3300 and House Bill 3400, which passed the House with no votes. Both those bills came out of Representative Close's House Business Committee. I would also like to take this opportunity to especially thank the Department of Consumer and Business Services and John Schultz. One of the things this bill does is it eliminates the filing of 18,000 pieces of paper per year with the department.
Ooh.
Not only did they not object to losing those 18,000 pieces of paper per year, they also suggested language on page 7 of the bill, at the very end of the bill, that would mandate that they do a review of other claims reporting requirements. So we're very optimistic that we can move forward with this as a platform and lose even more pieces of paper. On my left today is Linda Barno, chair of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association, and she'd be happy to help answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Do you have testimony?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The only thing that I would like to add about this bill is that it was really a good working relationship with all members of both labor and management and the MLEC group and the Workers' Compensation Department, and that this bill will not in any way affect benefits due to injured workers, which is a top priority for all of us.
Any questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. And no one else scheduled to testify on this bill. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 914. And we will look to have a work session on this a little later. So nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.